This episode of Section D was first broadcast on Tuesday, the 19th of February, 2013, on Monocle 24. Section D is brought to you in association with Lexus. Hello and welcome to Section D, the weekly design hour here on Monocle 24 with me, Hugo MacDonald. On this week's episode, we delve into the pages of a beautiful new book by Gestalten. It's called A Map of the World, according to illustrators and storytellers. And it's just as well, because in the rest of the show, we travel from Vancouver to London to Madrid to Lahore. We'd have been fairly lost without a map. Coming up on the show, ahead of the 57th Madrid Fashion Week, we pull up a pew with the director of the Spanish Fashion Designers Association.
I've seen only a few, and not only abroad, in my country too, don't know that Fortuny was a Spanish design, and Balenciaga and Paco Rabanne is a communication problem.
And we talk silk with Bulgarian fashion designer Marina Gergova at the Scoop Trade Show in London's Saatchi Gallery.
I've always loved the idea of silk being such a precious fabric and having value. And I've always seen it in collections, but never really done on its own as a niche. That's why I wanted to concentrate exclusively on silk.
Plus, we stay on the Silk Road and talk collaborations with Hermes and Comme des Garçons. Over in Lahore, we meet an architect making a difference to Pakistan's urban development. Monocle's creative director, Richard Spencer Powell, talks illustrated maps. And we're given a tour of the studio of Australian design collective Antipodean too. That's all to come on this week's episode of Section D, with me, Hugo MacDonald. We begin this week's Section D in Spain. Madrid's Mercedes-Benz Fashion Week is celebrating its 57th year this week. This year, the spotlight has been firmly placed on young designers, highlighting the sense of a real changing of the guard in Spanish fashion. Our man in Madrid, Liam Aldus, seized the opportunity to sit down with Lucia Cordero, the director of ACME, which is the Spanish Fashion Designers Association. Over morning tea in one of Monocle's favourite cafes, the two discussed the state of the industry, the all-powerful shadow cast by Inditex and its fast fashion concept, and also the impact that young designers are having on brand Spain.
In these 15 years, many things have changed in Spain. At this moment, we have a very important country in fashion, with fast fashion, with Inditex at first, and after we have other brands like Mango or Corte Fiel. And at the same time, we have many small and many independent fashion designers.
Do you think this is a problem in Spain, that perhaps Spanish fashion is only associated with fast fashion and the real creators and the real talent is being overshadowed by the Inditex giants?
It's a general problem. It's not only about Spain. You know France only about luxury, and Italy only about the big brands of Pret-a-Porter. And the same is in Spanish. Spanish is one of the three countries very important in fashion around the world, with fast fashion.
And your role has been to really bring the attention back to these smaller designers and creators.
We work about commercial project, cultural project, about exhibition, Spanish fashion, about books, many, many things. We work with the Spanish institution, European institution. We work in general every day, fighting for the best thing for the Spanish designers.
That's perhaps a problem as well. I mean, we're talking a lot about problems now, but we'll get onto some positive things soon, I promise. Maybe one of the problems is that some of the very famous Spanish designers aren't associated with Spain as a country. A lot of people don't understand or even realize that they're Spanish, like Manolo Blahnik. Maybe some shoe aficionados will know that he's Spanish, but a lot of people just know the brand. They don't know that he's Spanish. Why is that?
First, I think because Spain is not a good country for communicate our best things.
Selling itself. Huh?
Exactly. We are not Italian. We can't speak about our culture, about our good things. I think only a few, and not only abroad, in my country too, don't know that Fortuny was Spanish design, and Balenciaga, and Paco Rabanne, and now Manolo Blahnik. But it's a communication problem.
Do you think it's changing, though? Do you think now the Spanish, particularly with the crisis, are waking up and learning how to sell themselves abroad a bit better?
Yes. At this moment, the economic crisis, everybody in my country think we must go to the other countries to show our work in other countries. Now we have, you can show at New York, Custo Barcelona and Del Pozo. In Paris, in the 4th of March, we can see the collection of Mayer Zuaga. Also in London, the last week, Emilio de la Morena. At this moment, we must speak about a new Spanish generation. We have to speak about designers as Maria Barros, Echeverria, Moisés Nieto, Rabaneda, young designers who works recuperating the Spanish industry and the Spanish handmade. They prefer to show the best of our culture, because we think it's the only way to survive to fast fashion. I think we live a very important change. At this moment, Spanish designers like to show their work about the Spanish culture. This is not frequent, this is not normal. We can show the last collection of Givenchy, Ralph Lauren, many foreign designers, and the Spanish culture is real present in this collection, but it's difficult to find the Spanish culture in our designer because they try to be global, not so local. But at this moment, maybe for the crisis too, because the crisis is not only economic, it's a big change in our way of thinking, our way of living. And the young designer thinking, in some case, in all way to work. We must work with our culture, we must work with our industries, etc., etc.
Is this an advantage that Spain has? Because when you look at countries such as France and Italy, they've got their big luxury brands, and perhaps there isn't a lot of room to move for the smaller up-and-coming designers because the market is quite crowded by the big players. But Spain doesn't have a lot of these big players. So do you think there's a lot of potential in Spain for younger designers?
I've seen Spanish designers have some advantage because, as you know, in Spain, we don't have, in general, luxury brands or big pret-a-porter brands, and we have a lot of liberty. That's why I think we have more than 45 labels. We need to recuperate our best industries and at the same time to put the focus in the creation, not only in fashion, why not in cuisine or in other sectors too. At this moment, we are very proud about our country. We know that we have several problems, but at the same time, we know that we are a very important culture, a country with a big history, many centuries fighting, and we began to have some confidence in our possibilities.
That was Lucia Cordero, the director of the Spanish Fashion Designers Association, talking to our Madrid correspondent Liam Aldous there. If you've just joined us, you're listening to Section D here on Monocle 24. Lots more coming up, including an Arca tour in Lahore and a nice chat about illustrated maps with Monocle's creative director. Next up, though, we'll be dropping in on Scoop, the emerging trade show for women's wear held at London's Saatchi Gallery.
You're listening to Section D on Monocle 24, our weekly program on the best in design, architecture, graphics, and fashion. Section D is brought to you by Lexus. Lexus, creating a new chapter in amazing design, technology, and driving.
Welcome back to Section D. Days before Fashion Week kicked off in London, there was another fashion gathering taking place in the capital. Housed at the Saatchi Gallery in West London, Scoop International is a boutique womenswear trade show, showcasing more than 400 emerging and established designers. Launched in February 2011, Scoop's fifth season took place from the 10th to the 12th of February. The next edition is scheduled for the 21st to the 23rd of July later this year. While scouting for the latest on the independent fashion scene, our associate editor Nelly Gochiva checked in with two promising young designers. First, she stopped by Marina London, a new brand by young Bulgarian designer Marina Gergova, specialising in wardrobe essentials exclusively made in silk.
I started in 2011 and I had this idea after working for a year and a half for someone else that I really wanted to start a silk-based brand that only did 100% silks. Very classic, very simple shapes, wearable. And so I did in 2011 and I've been going for three seasons now, just exhibiting my fourth.
And can you tell us more about your presence here at Scoop? I hear that it's your first trade fair.
Yes, it's my first trade fair and I selected it mainly because of the location. I thought it's such a beautiful space, combining fashion and art, and the lighting is beautiful. So that's why I decided to do it. And yeah, it's my first time. Hopefully it'll go well.
Tell me now more about your fabrics. You said you work exclusively with silk. Where is your fascination with silk coming from?
I think when I was graduating, I did quite a lot of silkware in my graduation collection. And I've always loved the idea of silk being such a precious fabric and having value. And I've always seen it in collections, but never really done on its own as a niche. And so I kind of started thinking about it and I grew to really love the idea of it. And that's why I wanted to concentrate exclusively on silk. Now I've moved to Bulgaria, which is where I'm from. So I feel very, very happy to be producing there. I can help, you know, local commerce, and it's just, I feel so happy to be back in Bulgaria and producing there and working with my own country and my own language, being able to control quality control without a middleman, you know, no kind of lost in translation moments.
How important is the quality for you, and what is the importance of the Made in label?
Well, the Made in label, I've always wanted it to be in Europe, because with a lot of the silks, actually, they are made in China, because the silk is sourced from China, then delivered to the factory where it's made in China. I do source my silks from China, but I'm very adamant they're made in Europe. And I've always wanted to go back to Bulgaria because quality there is actually fantastic. My factory that I use is incredible. It's just had EU investment, so it's wonderful. And quality is top quality. I mean, I finish all my seams with French seaming. There's no overlocking, which is a technique that cheapens a garment and makes it quicker to make. So all the ways which silk should be finished, I use. So very important to me.
After Marina London, we stopped by Harris Wharf, run by Turin native Giulia Acchiardi. The label offers men's and women's ready-to-wear collections with a focus on unstructured outerwear. All made in Acchiardi's family factory in Turin, the garments are now available at the Harris Wharf shops in London and Turin, and also at Dover Street Market in Ginza and in London.
I studied at Marangoni in between Milan and London. 3 years ago, I started my own brand that is based in London, as we have a shop in Camden Passage. The whole collection is produced in Italy, in my family factory, together with my brother Aldo. So he takes part of on the commercial side, and I do the design and all the creative side of the whole collection. Our idea, in general, our concept is to have all outerwear mainly, all unlined. So we use usually jersey and knitted materials made with felted fabrics. So the final result is very casual, not formal at all, and very comfortable.
So, Julia, it's your third time here at Scope International. Can you tell me why do you find this particular fair good fit for your brand?
I like very much the idea of merging art with fashion, and the choice of the location for me has been a very good reason to participate, because it's a very selected brand trade show, and we've been participating, as you said, since three collections, because we would like to improve our English market, but at the same time giving a bit a stress on the location and avoiding the bigger shows that I don't think would reflect our philosophy. We have a distributor in Japan, and is the Moride company that distributes, and I have to say they are doing a very great job. Also, they have both men's and women's collection, and I have to say that it has very successful at the moment. We are also planning to increase our presence in America. We just had a new distributor in America working with us.
And what's happening with Harris Wharf in Europe? I know that you're pretty loved in Italy, obviously, and you're also available here at your own shop in London, but also at Dover Street Market in London. Where else can we find you in Europe?
In Europe, we are developing the German market, because again we have an agent there, and it's getting bigger also in Germany, because they are developing it very, very strongly. They believe in our collection, and especially in general, everybody starts to understand the nice thing to have an unstructured garment. It's hard to get back to the structured once you are used with a coat like that would stretch and would take the shape of your body. So everything starts like with a little orders, maybe. They want to try it, and they understand it works, and then they get enthusiastic about it and come back. And that's the nicest thing in every fair, to see everybody enthusiastic and happy about the result.
That was Julia Acchiardi from Harris Wharf talking to our associate editor Nelly Gochiva there at the Scoop Trade Show in London's Saatchi Gallery. You're listening to Section D. Next up, we'll be joined in the studio by Monocle's creative director, Richard Spencer-Powell. Richard Spencer-Powell, Monocle's creative director, joins me now in the studio. Thank you, Rich, as ever. We brought in a beautiful new book by Gestalten called A Map of the World, which is a compilation of several beautifully illustrated maps from a whole range of sources, including quite a hefty amount of content from Monocle.
Yes, we are given quite a bit of lip service in there. Sort of 5, 6, even 7 of our illustrators featured. And I'm pleased to say, right across the 6 volumes that we've been doing it, so some of these illustrators were in issue 1 or 2 and right up to issue 60. So it's
well done, you.
Yes, I'm very pleased about that.
I'm big glad on the back.
Hopefully made their job easier when it comes to research.
Start by asking you why you think this book has been made now, because illustrated maps sort of have a bit of an archaic appeal to them. It's definitely not something new, but it does seem to be something that there's been a resurgence of late. Why do you think that is?
In general, I think people have always loved a map. That's why they've featured very prominently in Monocle. And I think one of two things. I think, firstly, that in the last sort of 15 years, we've seen a resurgence in infographics in design, and all manner of design, that is. And I think people were trying to make information very appealing and very slick. And what tended to happen was it got more and more intricate, and it was almost a one-upmanship as who could make the nicest infographic. And what happened was everything became more illustrative. And from that point, then world maps became more illustrative. And I think, therefore, sort of, hey presto, we end up with this illustrated world map. I also think we've got a love of looking back into the past, and I think that's incorporated in sort of Victoriana design and looking at children's books, book cover designs, book illustration. And I think in there we see these lovely old, and there's a sweetness to them and an innocence to them.
Mm, it's naivety, sort of, isn't there?
Yeah, and there's something about, you get a lot of sort of bang for your buck with an illustrated map, because you can pore over them and you can spend a lot of time looking at them. They're not a kind of a quick scan, and yes, of course, I know what the world looks like.
Mm.
It's always nice to see what an illustrator's take on Moscow is, you know, the little bits and bobs, the little people, the characters, the little finesses that they put on. That's the charm. I think that as a reader, that's what stops you in your tracks. And yeah, you give that page an extra sort of 10 minutes of your time.
And as a creative director of a magazine, it's an opportunity also to really sort of drive home the character and the personality of the brand through something like that as well, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think not only our brand, but our view of the world. So there'll be countries and places that, you know, if The Economist, for example, does a map of Russia, that it'll be a very straight map of Russia. If we do a map of Russia, you might see the sort of Trans-Siberian Express kind of thing with Cossacks and all sorts of things going on. So it's just a little bit more playful. It's a little bit more of an old romantic view of the world. And I think it just touches on more of the things that we're about.
Mm-hmm.
And what you know, people sometimes forget about the world. So it's a kind of good vehicle for both, really.
Going back to the book itself, I mean, it strikes me as maybe quite an easy book to put together. Is that...
Yes, because it's predominantly big, lovely images, and I don't think I would have done anything differently with them. Mm. You want to see them big, you know. Maps tend to work well big in poster form. You often run them as spreads in magazines. In in-flight magazines, they're always run as spreads, and I always look at them when I'm bored on a flight. So I don't think I would have done anything different with it. It's easy to pull together today because there are so many of these things out there now, you know, in terms of people doing illustrated maps in books, in travel guides, in magazines. And I think Gestalten have done a good job with their graphic design books over the last 2 years. Recently, they did some very nice infographics books, two of those they've done. So this, I think, is a logical step for them. It's the right move. I'm sure they have a readership that's out there and just waiting for this book. And it's a great addition to a studio's bookshelf.
As a resource, or just as something to think, oh, well, actually, it's interesting that they have pulled these graphic designers from these parts of the world. Maybe there's a really good school that we hadn't heard about that is churning out good talent from there.
Yeah, possibly. I mean, it's set up as a resource book, but it's a very enjoyable one. It's one of those things that, again, you can just pore over. And there's a lot packed into these maps. So even if it's not the map that you're after, but you want someone that can draw nice little buildings, you can find it on one of these maps. So it's a good resource and it's a good source of inspiration. There's many, many ideas in there, and colours and type and everything. So it's a good one, I think.
And if we've whetted your appetite for maps, perhaps that should be mappetite, then download episode 70 of The Urbanist, which is entirely map themed, something of a map extravaganza, if you will. Still to come in part two of Section D, we head to Lahore to talk architecture. We sit down with the creative director of Vertu, and we talk silk scarves with the managing director of silk and textiles at Hermes 2. We're off to Vancouver now, though. The word basketry conjures up less modernity, more old-school crafters producing pieces in bucolic cottage industries. But in Vancouver, there's a 19-year-old who's turning that notion on its head by sewing together abstract forms from coiled rope. He's called Landon Dix, and he's an interior design student determined to inject a more minimalist aesthetic to a traditionally rustic technique. On a weapons-grade industrial sewing machine, our reporter in Vancouver, Lucy Hislop, takes a lesson in some mean zigzag stitching.
Landon Dix is cranking his slightly scuffed, grey industrial sewing machine to the max this afternoon. On top of the bobbin lies a coil of rope, which he rotates under the fast-paced needle. He's on deadline. There's a pop-up shop next week that he needs to feed, and a rush of back orders for his trivets, coasters, fruit bowls and lampshades. As he speeds ahead in the clean-lined studio-cum-nook in his family home in North Vancouver, Dix talks through the process.
Essentially, it's taking the end of a really long piece of rope. You measure out your rope first, depending on what basket you're going to make, or basket, bowl, whatever it might be. And you just make a little coil and create a cross right at the start. And essentially, you feed it through the sewing machine. And on the left-hand side of your needle, you're producing your finished form. And on the right side, you have a piece of rope feeding into it. And it just constantly grows. You just coil it and coil it. And depending on the tension that you're pulling on the feed end, and the way your hand is angled on the completed side, you can really create anything without a mold.
It's this that's so key to his free-flowing technique.
It gives me the freedom to really create organic shapes. Nothing is exactly replicated. It's all handmade, and there's irregularities in the stitching. I might miss joining together a piece of rope and have to overlap it, and it really just adds character to it. The fact that there's no mold really just gives me unlimited opportunity of what I can create.
Of course, what starts as strong, starched, but soft cotton rope ends up as a somewhat surprisingly rigid, abstract form. All something he discovered after taking a few sewing classes as part of an interior design course and investing $500 in a second-hand machine via Craigslist. While riffing on the old Native American techniques, Dix explains how he feels he is reinventing the craft of coiling.
I mean, I have no Native American ancestry, but I mean, obviously being on the Pacific Northwest coast, you're surrounded by the culture, and it's great to see Native art everywhere, and just you can draw from that. I mean, coiling up rope, the way I do it is different from the ancient technique, but it's all the same idea, where what they did was they took reeds and barks and different things and coiled those up and binded them together, whereas we already have the technology where rope is already made and it's just simple to do. You can create as long as you want these giant pieces that are seamless. It's not widely known. It's an ancient technique that has never really been brought to modern times, but it's so simple and so modern and minimal and functional.
Folding back a decorative oriental screen and walking down a hall, Dix is taking me to his workshop garage, where he's working on yet another piece. It's here that his clever rope trickery will still be evident. But instead of baskets, he's introducing a piece of wood into the mix, freshly salvaged from a shoreline a couple of hours north of Vancouver. White may be his default colour choice, but everything depends on his mood.
I often work up the Sunshine Coast at my cabin up there, and when I'm up there, I'd love to incorporate the navies, incorporate the greens, and kind of focus on that natural forest where we're on the Pacific Coast, really create these natural-looking pieces.
Just beside the industrial rolls of rope and spools of multicoloured thread, Dick starts in on the air compressor. The coiled rope will eventually be attached to form part of the seat on this timber stool, all with his distinctive stitch.
Typically, I just use the zigzag stitch in varying widths. So the tighter I do the stitch, or the narrower, the more condensed it looks. It can even look like a solid band of color. There's special occasions where I do throw in a decorative stitch, but there's never really too much meaning behind it. It's just all aesthetics.
Dubbed from Alfred to Jolene, Dix always likes to attach descriptions to his myriad pieces.
The names, I come up with the names just to create a unique name. You don't normally hear names like Franklin and Felicity. And there's a couple that do have some meaning to me. For example, Waldorf, which is one that I've recently created. The Waldorf Hotel was a iconic cultural landmark in Vancouver that's recently closed down for development. And the biography I've written about Waldorf, this big round basket, is Waldorf is something where you can gain memories and share them with your kids and grandkids, and he's a cavernous fellow that makes your night so much better. It's just reminds me of the Waldorf Hotel.
As I leave him planing down his wood with his orbital sander, I know that it won't be long before Dix christens this coiled stool and creates an equally inventive history to boot. For Monocle, in Vancouver, I'm Lucy Hislop.
Thank you for that, Lucy. You're listening to Section D with me, Hugo MacDonald, on Monocle 24. We're heading to Lahore after this.
You're listening to Section D on Monocle 24, our weekly program on the best in design, architecture, graphics, and fashion. Section D is brought to you by Lexus. Lexus, creating a new chapter in amazing design, technology, and driving.
This is Section D on Monocle 24. Welcome back. Now, how do you thrive as an architect in one of the world's most troubled developing countries? Nayar Ali Dada, based in Lahore, has always had his work cut out for him. But over the last 40 years, he's successfully made a unique contribution to the urban landscape of Pakistan, against many odds. Saima Tariq met him in his office to discuss his work and philosophy, before going for a drive through his sprawling hometown to visit one of his favourite buildings.
In a humble office off Lahore's busy canal road, behind an antique door with no sign, Nayar Ali Dada is sitting at his desk, awards and artifacts displayed behind him. Bunches of finely sharpened Faber-Castell pencils atop his desk belie his artistic background. He always does his architectural drawings by hand. The only Pakistani to win the Aga Khan Architectural Award, Ali Dada's career has seen him build some of the country's most notable buildings and institutions, from hotels and banks to art centres and libraries. After 40 years, he is still negotiating urban landscapes marked by a scarcity of resources combined with chronically unchecked growth.
Architecture in Pakistan has had its complexities and problems all through, but peculiar problems regarding this region. One is an issue of identity, and the other is resisting the general trend of commercialization and the assault of modernism onto environment and other. So we are facing these problems, which are common to most third world countries. Producing architecture which following simple solutions of using the right material so that the economy, which is very desirable within our circumstances and comfort conditions, automatically in our format emerges, which carries both without really following either.
Ali Dada's buildings often use raw brick, a material typical of the Punjab, and he has a deep love for bare surface and mass forms. Unsurprisingly, he counts Japanese architect Tadao Ando and Sri Lankan Jeffrey Bawa as key influences. Lahore's Alhamra Arts Centre, for which Ali Dada won the Aga Khan Award, echoes their boldness and steadfast sense of location.
One of the examples is Alhamra itself, which is an extremely modern building, but you can't fit it into format of modern architecture. It has no glass like the modern buildings have, and cubes like the modern buildings have. And traditional, it evokes a little bit of feeling of Lahore, because it has solid brick walls, reminiscence of maybe the Lahore fort and all, but not deliberately at all. There are no cliches, there are no arches, there are no domes, see. So my message to my students of architecture and people in the profession has remained the same, that we should not be extremists following one philosophy. And you can follow either philosophy as long as you can justify it. Justify it where architecture is for its place, for its budget, which is mostly limited, for the purpose for which it is being built. And if you faithfully follow these, then automatically architecture emerges to be appropriate, reasonable, and surprisingly attractive as well.
The architect has a lot to say about the current state of his home city, which has unfortunately succumbed to the planning chaos that most of Pakistan suffers from.
It's a very tragic story. Lahore has gone down as a city. It's lost its character because of its sprawl, its commercial assault on it, its expansion, which has been without planning, mindless. And the architecture, which has emerged in the last 40, 50 years, has been terribly commercialized, and it's becoming ugly, because Lahore was a city of a lot of balance of character. We had heritage, invaluable heritage, starting from pre-Mughal period to Mughal period, then going through the British period, the Sikh period, and very nice mixture. It's like an history book, you know, moving onwards. But then the tragedy is that it produces structures which, and it's going to be heritage for tomorrow, and they are not mentionable as works of architecture. They are all boxes of concrete and steel.
From the bedlam of downtown to a leafy side street, where the Shakir Ali Museum sits in relative calm, the former residence of the late painter, who once taught Ali Dada, is now home to personal objects and paintings, and is still one of my interviewees' favourite buildings. Its long and narrow black wooden doors and windows that let in evening light and green views are housed in an incredibly textured exterior.
Luckily, we don't have machine-made bricks because they don't have the same class as the handmade brick has. This is our major building material. So as you can see, this was designed as a studio belonging to Professor Shakir Ali, who was a famous painter of the subcontinent. So he treated this house as a painting on the canvas, you know, and crafted it with my assistance as a draughtsman, you can say. So it's a joint project. And now it stands as an example of how simple architecture can deliver a character of relevance to its place. The inside also carries the same kind of language, which is subtle and rustic. And the proportions are, and the scale is quite remarkable, actually.
As Ali Dada continues to work, his current project, the park in Islamabad, he also continues to make his mark on Pakistan, one brick at a time. For Monocle in Lahore, I'm Saima Tariq.
You're listening to Section D with me, Hugo MacDonald, on Monocle 24. At the beginning of February, iconic heritage house Hermes officially launched its latest scarf collaboration with Japanese fashion brand Comme des Garçons. The limited edition scarves are exclusively available in the Comme des Garçons shops in Paris, New York and Tokyo, as well as Dover Street Market in London and Ginza. The hot silks will be on sale only until the end of March. Our associate editor Nelly Gocheva met Victor Borges, head of silk at Hermes, right after the launch in Tokyo and hours before the official launch in London. She began by asking how and why Hermes had picked Ray Kawakubo of Comme des Garçons to collaborate with.
Well, Ray Kawakubo has always inspired Bali Balin, our woman universe artistic director. What Bali likes on her is her passion for drawings and printed fabrics. That's why Ray has often used silk scarves to create clothes. So this project with Comme des Garçons consists on pure pleasure and the magic for unexpected meetings between two persons that love the same thing.
And can you just tell us more about the collection itself? What should we expect from this collaboration? Main colors and fabrics, of course, the fabric is always silk. Can you just tell us more about this?
Beautiful and iconic Hermes silk scarves with a touch of strong and creative Comme des Garçons spirit in two different versions, the black and white sari and a more colorful one. The black and white, we are presenting it in the Comme des Garçons stores in New York, Paris, and Aoyama in Japan, and the color collection in Dover Street Market in Ginza, and today we will launch it in London.
You just got back from Japan, actually, where you launched the collection. How did it go over there?
Well, like in Paris, we started in Paris, and then we went to New York. And after Tokyo, it has been a huge success in all the cities, and we are very happy to be now in London, where we are sure the destiny is quite strategic for us, and I'm sure the surprise will be very strong.
And if you go back to the collaboration, how did you manage to bring together Hermes's tradition and artisanal know-how with Comme des Garçons style vision?
Well, Ray Kawakubo came to print her spirit onto the Hermes Carré with a lot of simplicity in her approach. This with a great occurrence of respect for the Hermes tradition and craftsmanship.
Okay, and what would the collaboration with Comme des Garçons bring to Hermes? Are you targeting new type of customers or maybe new markets, geographically speaking?
Well, the result of this collaboration is very impressive and amazing. It has allowed us to create two unique and limited collections. It is a beautiful escape beyond the walls for us. It's not a strategy, but an encounter like all the collaborations at Hermes. It allows the Carré to be renewed.
It takes quite a long time to make a Hermes scarf. Can you just tell us more about the process of making one Hermes scarf?
Yeah, normally it takes between 18 months to 2 years. For example, this collaboration we started 2 years ago, and it's quite long because quality has to be there, excellence has to be there. Engraving, it's very important. It's a long process, for example, because we are using a lot of colors. We have many meetings every week for coloration, and then the production as well is quite a long process because we buy the yarn, we do the weaving, and we print, we finish the product, and of course then we have to ship all the stores, and it's a long process.
That was Victor Borges, head of silk at Hermes, talking to our associate editor, Nelly Gocheva, there. Meanwhile, across London, our associate business editor, Adrian Craddock, was busy at another product launch. Originally a subsidiary of Nokia, Vertu has been making high-end mobile phones since 1996. The company has since split from the Finnish phone giant, but their direction has remained virtually unchanged. Rare materials like titanium, sapphire, and even red gold feature heavily, with a price tag almost eight times that of the closest competitor. Curiously, though, when Adrian spoke with the brand's head designer, Hutch Hutchison, at the launch of Vertu's new phone, he took exception to categorising the brand as luxury.
It's funny that word luxury, because for me, we set out to build the best phones in the world out of the best materials, and people choose to put the luxury tag on it. I think it's quite a misleading thing. If you talk to Ferrari, and we work with Ferrari, we co-branded with them and work collaboratively, and nobody at Ferrari will tell you they make luxury cars. They make the best cars they can make, and people pay a lot for them, and people call it luxury. But according to them, they make race cars. According to me, I make that out of the best materials in the world, and people call it luxury. Like, you know, go way back. We spent, in the early days, 5 years refusing to put a single diamond on our phone because we knew where this was headed. It would go down this bling route. The early press coverage was all gold-plated phones with diamond-encrusted. We've never gold-plated anything in our lives. If you see a lump of gold on a phone, it's solid gold. So that wasn't true. And the funny thing is we'd never put a diamond on a phone when they were saying that. Nowadays, customers want stuff. The customer wants it. We will do it for them. But the core, I'd say 90% of what we sell is what you see here. That is built out of the best engineering materials for the purpose.
You're right. I mean, there are some real points of quality and you know, there's an amazing amount of care that goes into this product. What is the price tag, though? I mean, how much do you pay for a product like this?
That one there, 7,900 euros is the entry price point. That is the product there. That'll be the majority of what we sell, I expect. I can't quote off the top of my head. You move up a couple of price points. You've got Alligator. You've got... here are the phones underneath. Alligator, there. Same titanium.
That real Alligator...
Absolutely. Okay. Only the real stuff. That's kind of at the heart of... It's one of the things I believe we stand for, is authenticity.
So with that price point, who are you designing for? What markets are you usually looking at?
Our biggest markets at the moment are Western Europe and China. We don't design specifically for one market. The phones are the same globally. It's for people who've kind of got enough money where they want the best. And things like the iPhone, I would never say anything horrible about iPhones. I think they are fantastic. I think the Samsungs are fantastic. But my nephew's got one. My daughter's got one. If you're sitting in a car park and you've got a Bentley and you're sitting next to a Mini, why have you both got the same telephone? You know, that you just reach that point. But the trap is to stick diamonds on it to justify the price point.
I mean, I wanted to ask, you know, you mentioned the iPhone there. We're sitting in Covent Garden, just around the corner from London's flagship Apple store. That's been wildly successful for them, the iPhone, and it's basically the centerpiece is simplicity and minimalism, and it's quite a counterpoint to your phone, which is all about kind of features and not particularly minimalistic in any sense. Does that make you nervous at all? I mean, or are you just kind of taking a different tack?
Yeah, our approach is completely different. As I say, I think they've got a beautiful and wonderful product, but it is almost they've removed features to the point of it being anti-design. It is so simple, so clean, a wonderful thing. Rather than talk about their design, I'll talk about our design. Right at the core of what we do is this authenticity. Everything on there is there for a reason. And this leggy look, we've always gone for this rather vertical, dominant look, is there because of those beams that hold the whole thing together. You listen to it, so we've given you somewhere to put your ear. So we've added that piece there. On the back, all of this is actually a catch. So you flip it up, operate it, take off the back cover to get into your SIM card. Actually, while you're in there, you can see the signature of the person who's built it. one person, one phone. That's the ethos in our factory.
Why is that so important to your brand? I mean, looking through some of your marketing, that's always made very prominent. Why is that so important?
Well, this one was built by Shelley. I know Shelley. She's a really proud lady and a skilled craftsman. I mean, think about what it says to her if something she does isn't perfect. So there's an incredible empowerment of the person doing it. These aren't people who go into work just to get the money. These are people who care about what they do. There's that side of it. And there's also a kind of reassurance to the owner of this product that it was actually built by a real lady. They're welcome to go and see her. She'll find her sitting there paying real attention with a screwdriver, doing things up perfectly in a factory that says, actually, this was hand-built for me. And that is rather different from a sort of commodity item that exists in a sea of other products sitting in a warehouse that had been manufactured somewhere in the Far East. And you think, that's why I've just paid a bit more for this, that attention.
Virtu is all made in England, is that right?
Yeah, every phone's made in England.
Mm-hmm. So, I mean, is Englishness a part of the brand as far as you're concerned? Is the place it comes from a big part of the phones?
It's become it. I don't know what it stands for myself as an Englishman. I'm quite proud to be English. I live here. We build them in England. We build them in Hampshire, where we say we do. It's worked well for us because actually, and I was talking about Shelley, most of those ladies have come from the aerospace industry, and we sit in that M3, M4 corridor where there is actually a surprising amount of aerospace and also Formula One. And that has worked for us because the sort of British inventive streak in those cutting edge, those two technological areas are really perfect because they're not high volume mass manufacture, but they are pushing materials technology to where it can be. So it's had a lot of relevance in that respect. Other than that, it's just the truth. It's what we are. You know, I'm English.
That was Hutch Hutchison, head designer at Virtu, talking to our associate business editor, Adrian Craddock, there. You're listening to Section D. And that's almost all we have time for in this week's episode of Section D. Next week, we'll be hearing from Pierre de Meuron, one half of Herzog de Meuron. We'll be bringing you highlights from London Fashion Week, and we'll be talking all things leather with Bill Amberg in his studio too. Today's show was produced by Aled John and edited by Holly Fisher. You can contact our producer, Aled, at awj@monocle.com if you'd like to feature on Section D, or maybe just bend his ear about an idea you've had. I'm Hugo MacDonald, and before we leave you, there's time to debut a new regular feature here on Section D. Each week we'll be dropping into the studio of a different designer or architect to hear about the particulars of their workspace and the way that they work. With this in mind, we went to meet Jeffrey J. Finch, the creative director of fashion label Antipodium, in their studio on Winkley Street, on the borders of Bethnal Green and Hackney, in the East End of London.
Hello. Yeah, come straight up.
I am Jeffrey J. Finch. I am the creative director of Antipodium, and we are in Antipodium Towers. We're at number 7 Winkley Street, the heart of the East End. Antipodium is a contemporary ladies' wear brand. We started the label at London Fashion Week in September 2006, and now we sell internationally with stores like Liberty and Barney's and Isetan in Tokyo and throughout Australia, the States, Europe. Generally, there tend to be about 8 to 10 people here. We have quite a few freelancers, and so we have to sort of rotate the days around. We've actually very much outgrown the space and we'll need to move shortly, so we're having to be quite thrifty with how we use it. So, I guess we have a lot of our sampling fabrics here, all of our patterns and archive are stored here. We used to cut all of our patterns here, but unfortunately we don't have space for that anymore, so our freelancers work from their studio. We hold all of our stock for antipodium.com here as well. So this is the central system for it. Production happens here, sampling happens here, in-house PR and marketing, and then occasionally I sketch up a few things here as well. We have our production patterns lining up there, so now that our autumn-winter show is out of the way, then we'll be working on final production adjustments and putting it all in production in the next month. Then over here we have, well, most of them are out at the moment, which I guess is a good sign. We have some press samples, and we've just received our pre-fall collection back from Japanese sales. So yeah, I mean, I guess what's what is nice about this environment is that you see the whole, you know, and what I really like, for particularly for our interns that are here learning, is that, you know, they see from sketch stage through right through its sort of life through to sales and then into production, and then seeing the bulk delivery come in as well. So I think I hope that provides them with an interesting view on what happens in the world of fashion. I'm a very big Dolly Parton fan. One of my favourite songs of hers, and actually I don't know if it's that well known, is A Potential New Boyfriend, mainly because the lyrics in it are amazing, and it's Dolly at a disco phase. I mean, what more can you want in life?